morning, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. I'd like to introduce Joseph Lawless, who we had previously moved his admission pro hoc vice. He will be presenting the argument today, and I present him to you at this time.
Welcome to the court, Mr. Lawless.
Good morning, Your Honors, and thank you for the privilege of being here before. This is the second time I've had the opportunity to be before this court, and it's always a privilege to be permitted to practice here.
Welcome back. So you're familiar with how our clock works?
Oh, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
We've discussed that several times this morning already. I think, though, as Shakespeare said, as brevity is the soul of wit, so shall I be brief. I have two arguments I want to focus on. I have never been a fan of addressing an argument that a trial judge abused his or her discretion for two reasons. Number one, after 30 years, I have a lot of respect for trial judges. Number two, it's an uphill argument. But if I could just give a bit of the factual background, I'd like to address the first issue that we raise on behalf of Mr. Page in his Rule 61 motion. I'm assuming the court is familiar with the procedural history, the trial, the conviction, the court upholding the verdict on its direct appeal.
We can assume we all know that.
Okay, we filed a timely Rule 61 motion, and the trial judge, Judge Abelson, requested that the record be expanded by affidavit under the rules. We were waiting for a copy of the affidavits when we received an opinion from Judge Abelson summarily dismissing the Rule 61 petition, or the first opinion, which is part of the record in this case. We then filed a motion to reconsider based on our understanding that the rule required the court to permit us to review the affidavit, to provide it to our client, and to allow him, if he so desired, to file a supplemental affidavit. Judge Abelson.
It's Abelman.
Abelman, I'm sorry. I'm actually thinking of another judge. I apologize for that. Judge Abelman denied the motion, and we filed our briefs in this court. The state then, while after we filed our brief, part of which requested a remand because of the Rule 61 issue, essentially agreed with our petition and our earlier petition and another ruling of this court, filed a motion to remand, and the court sent it back to the trial court. We then received a copy of the one affidavit that was filed by the one trial counsel, Mr. Figliola, which was essentially, and it's part of the record, I think it was 12 paragraphs, 10 or 12 paragraphs, simply saying denied, 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 denied. And once I received it, I couldn't tell what it was, and I ended up calling Mr. Figliola and asked him, and he explained this is simply our denials to the questions that the judge posed in her letter, which are set forth in our brief. I reviewed them with my client. He then filed a supplemental affidavit addressing in more detail the specific issues that he raised, and it was filed with the court. We also requested an evidentiary hearing because for two reasons. Number one, the issues that he raised with respect to consultation with counsel, et cetera, were fact-specific. Plus, Judge Abelman's directive was to both trial counsel. The affidavit only came from one of the two, and not only did my client state in his affidavit, but it's clear from the record, most of the case was tried by other counsel, Mr. Gabay, and most of the interactions were with Mr. Gabay. So we believed, and I still believe, at this point, there are issues that are yet unresolved that can't be addressed simply by a mere denial of one of two counsel.
Was any application made to Judge Abelman to issue a rule to show cause to Mr. Gabay for failing to comply with the directive or to compel Mr. Gabay to show up?
Your Honor, when we filed our responsive affidavit, it was clear, well, it was in the affidavit that in order for us to address some of the issues, specifically the time spent with counsel, the visits, et cetera, we requested an evidentiary hearing to permit the right to subpoena the records. Did we file a specific request with the court below to do that? No, and if we didn't, that's on me. Frankly, Your Honor, I believed that would have been self-evident to the court based on, one, the fact that Mr. Gabay didn't file an affidavit in and of itself, and two, the fact that Mr. Figliola's denials were simply that, denials. And the best example I could give, and it's in the brief, where Mr. Page is discussing the fact that he didn't have an opportunity to consult with his attorney. That's denied. Well, consultations could be in the middle of a trial, you turn to your client, did you understand that? Yeah. I mean, to the extent that Tony, who I know and respect and I think is an experienced lawyer, you know, could answer the deny the allegations, yes. But to the extent the court needs that information to fairly determine the issue, I think more is required. And I think if the court...
Let me interrupt you for a moment just so I understand where we're going with the argument. As I understand it, based on where we are so far, your client filed a Rule 61 motion. The response was a summary denial from one of two attorneys. When you got that, your relief that was requested in the Superior Court was for additional discovery and a hearing. Instead of that, you got an opinion from Judge Abelman that explained why the motion was denied. So when we're talking about the judge's exercise of discretion in this case, am I correct that what you want is a remand to the Superior Court so that you can take additional discovery, perhaps, but for sure have a hearing, and then have the judge rule on the Rule 61 motion after a full hearing?
Yes, Your Honor. In an ideal world, and I believe that a trial judge in any jurisdiction has broad discretion, the most expeditious way to do that would be to say to defense counsel.
The answer is yes. That's
the answer,
what you're looking
the answer
for.
Is yes.
Okay. Next question is,
I should know that after all.
What is the precise issue that we're being asked to decide?
The precise issue is whether or not the trial judge abused her discretion in summarily denying the petition relief for ineffective assistance of counsel in the absence of a fully developed record. And what we're requesting there is a remand, and what I think the trial judge should do and could do is simply say, you can have discovery to the extent where you want the visitation records, the time records of counsel with respect to this case. I would want them more broadly, and that would be the time records of counsel with respect to the other court-appointed homicide cases, because that goes to the broader question of the ineffectiveness argument that we make in point two of our brief.
Well, that's something you could sort out with the trial judge if there was a remand.
Yes, sir.
But going back to my precise question, your contention is you acknowledge you don't have to have a hearing in every Rule 61 case.
Absolutely.
But in this first-degree murder case, when you have an affidavit from only one of two counsel and the affidavit is cryptic by simply having denials, it was incumbent on the Superior Court to hold a hearing to develop a record before the motion was decided. So what you want us to do is remand it.
Yes, sir.
For discovery as the trial judge deems appropriate and for a hearing. Is that right?
Precisely. It may be that I'm requesting broader discovery than the trial judge would be willing to grant, but I think if the court were to permit the denial to stand on the basis of this record, you're really kind of lowering the bar for claims of ineffective assistance where you have specific allegations and simple denials. That being the case, I think the court understands the issue that I've raised. The other issue that I would like to address is the general overall ineffectiveness claim that was raised by Mr. Page. And this is, in my experience, this is an issue that I think is not only important.
The issue being what?
The issue being ineffective assistance of counsel under the circumstances of this case. Your Honor, there's an old expression, if you don't have the law, you argue the facts. If you don't have the facts, you argue the law. If you don't have either, you address the Constitution.
Actually, I think the old adage is you beg at the table and shout like hell.
Sometimes that works, Your Honor, but it also helps if you know what to shout. And a case like this, and I know this court has addressed many death penalty cases, death is different. Death is different in every respect. And if...
Well, you're saying, is this an alternative argument?
Yes, sir.
That is, on this record, inadequate as it is, there's still a basis to reverse for reasons of counsel's ineffectiveness?
Yes, sir.
Because?
Two things, Your Honor. Number one, conflict counsel was appointed and right out of the box, their first request to the court is, we need to continue this case. We can't comply with Administrative Directive 88. We can't be ready within a year because of other court-appointed cases. That being the case, my belief is that counsel had an obligation to, one, advise the court, and, two, decline the appointment, suggest to the court it find someone else, because any defense counsel in any case, but most particularly in a case where the state is seeking the death penalty, has an obligation to raise every possible legitimate constitutional issue. And if ab initio they don't have the time to prepare, you're saying right away, we're going to have to give up our client's right to a speedy trial. That also, by the way, on this record, was done without even consulting with their client. What gets into an issue later on, which frankly I found more intriguing constitutionally, was as they were preparing for trial after this delay, and I'm sure the court remembers this. This is back, I think, 2002 or 2003. There was a problem with funding for experts and investigators. And the investigator and the psychiatric expert who was retained in this case, and a psychiatric expert in the death penalty case, obviously has importance for a number of reasons, came to counsel and said, okay, we have bills in other cases from the state. They're not getting paid. We can't proceed without getting something paid in advance. The trial judge wrote a letter to this court. Justice Steele sent a letter back saying, unless the governor changes the line items submitted to the Joint Finance Committee, we're not going to have money for X period of time.
Can you focus on, I mean, there's obviously two prongs to a Sixth Amendment claim in this context.
The right.
Counsel's conduct is unreasonable. Let's assume that's accepted. What is the prejudice prong? How have you satisfied the prejudice prong at this point?
Well, Your Honor, again, under the line of cases with Arizona versus Fulminante, et cetera, there are certain constitutional infirmities you can have in a prosecution that are so systemic that a defendant need not establish prejudice.
So you're asking us to presume prejudice on this record?
I think on this record you have to look at it and say, here you have and it's kind of a confluence of facts. You have a situation where, for whatever reason, the state of Delaware, hasn't provided, and I guess that's the key, because we're now talking about Gideon versus Wainwright, hasn't provided an adequate number of experienced conflict counsel to handle death penalty cases, such that you're now pushing cases back a year because you don't have other people to do that. And then, once that you have counsel for those defendants, you're hamstringing them in terms of their ability to retain experts, to hire experts, et cetera. And that, to me, and it's a function of a criminal defendant, I believe, getting caught between, and this could be true in every jurisdiction, the politics of the legislature and the needs of the judiciary.
Have you alleged that there is evidence, or proffered that there's evidence, that because of this conduct of counsel, the outcome would have been different if they had done the case?
Your Honor, is there evidence of the outcome being different? No, and I think that goes to the prejudice. However, I think the reason that the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court cases have come up with the idea of an inherent prejudice that eliminates the need to show actual prejudice is because where you have such an infirmity in a case, I mean, I could stand up and give you five or six things that could have been done different, that could have affected the outcome, but we'll never know because of the nature of the system that was unable to be done by counsel.
All right, so let me see if I have this right. You're really you're making one argument with two branches, or maybe two alternative arguments. The argument being that on this record, inadequate though it may be, the court should conclude that there was ineffective assistance. Number one, because counsel who agreed to take the case weren't able to get it to trial in time, and as a consequence basically forewent their client's speedy trial rights. And secondly, even if they hadn't done that is, even if they could have gone to trial within the necessary time limit, they were precluded from doing it because there was no money to retain an expert to testify at the trial. Is that correct?
They're related and yet unrelated, Your Honor. The ineffective assistance argument that I think is clear from the face of the record is the fact that because of whatever reason, the defense of this particular indigent defendant was not adequately funded because adequate counsel was not available to bring the case to trial. You're now forcing a defendant to start making decisions between constitutional rights. And granted, that is done all the time in other cases,
sorry,
depending upon circumstances.
Are you, not making those two arguments?
I am making those two arguments.
Okay. The second argument may moot the first. That is, if that argument is correct, the speedy trial issue would be secondary.
If the court takes a look at this and decides there was a systemic problem with the issue, I think the remedy is you've got to remand it for a new trial with counsel that's not going to have that problem.
Is it accurate, though, that ultimately, whatever the deficiency with having experts and having them testify at the trial, that that was remedied at the trial that ultimately occurred? It's just your view is it took too long for that to happen.
Well, Your Honor, it was remedied in the sense that, yeah, ultimately were they available, ultimately they were there. But my problem with the way this transpired, Judge, Your Honor, if I may, is in a death penalty case, counsel has to be able to focus on defending his client, raising the issues, raising the claim, and can't have to worry about a schedule they can't keep up with, or delay caused by whether or not my expert's getting paid or even being considered. That's an issue. That's a constitutional issue which I think defense counsel should have taken advantage of. If you're standing in a trial court and all of a sudden you're not able to be funded, you raise that issue in the lower court. You don't walk in and say, I'm going to raise speedy trial because I can't be effective. You go into the court and say, Your Honor, it's the state's obligation to not put my client in this position, and seek some relief, seek the court to order the legislature to change the funding, file something in federal court. But here, the choice between these two constitutional issues is not being forced by something inherent in the nature of the practice of law. It's being forced by the fact that the state didn't meet its constitutional obligations under Gideon to properly and timely fund the defense. And I think under Fulminante in those cases, that's a systemic problem that doesn't require a showing of prejudice regardless of the outcome. That being the case, I think the court understands the issues, and unless there are any further questions, I would ask leave to be seated.
Very well, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Wakely.
Good morning, Justice Holland. May it please the court, James Wakely on behalf of the state of Delaware. Addressing Mr. Page's first argument, there is no basis to conclude that one member of a trial team is not competent to speak for both.
That may be the case, but what does the record reflect about why Mr. Gabay didn't respond? As I read the record, both counsel were asked to respond, and Mr. Gabay simply didn't respond. And while Mr. Figliola did, he didn't say, I'm responding on behalf of both of us. He just responded. And so there's a separate issue. One is, was Mr. Figliola's response adequate? But the bigger issue is, how does an officer of the court who's directed to file an affidavit simply not respond?
Your Honor, it's not clear from the record why Mr. Gabay did not separately respond. In fact, the only interpretation I can surmise, it comes from Mr. Lawless's first argument where he spoke, obviously it is outside the record, with Mr. Figliola, who said it was our denials of the allegations made in the post-conviction motion, which indicates certainly that he believes he's speaking on behalf of Mr. Gabay as well.
Can you explain what the practice is now when an ineffective assistance of counsel claim is made? Essentially, the state's role becomes defending the adequacy of the defense counsel's performance.
Yes, sir.
Before the superior court. That usually involves some form of contact, consultation, maybe even calling the person as a witness during the course of any proceeding if there's an evidentiary hearing. Did anything like that happen in this case? Does the record reflect that one way or another?
No, Your Honor. The state was never directed to respond to Mr. Page's motion for post-conviction relief below, nor was there any contact by the state with Mr. Figliola or Mr. Gabe.
So that type of contact is triggered when you get a instruction from the court to file a response to the motion. Is that in practice what happens?
Yes, Your Honor. Typically, that type of event, it happens routinely in more serious cases such as these. We may not always be called to respond in lesser cases where the record is clear that the allegations in the ineffectiveness motion, given that they're typically drafted by pro se defendants, are easily resolved by the record. That's typically when we would not be asked to respond, at least in practice. Here, Mr. Page was required to overcome the presumption, the very strong presumption that what counsel did was appropriate. The allegations made at the Superior Court level were extremely general. They made no allegation of prejudice. Even to this day, he is unable to make any allegation of prejudice. To the extent that he has raised on appeal any specific deficiencies by counsel, the state can only determine that they are failure to present the speedy trial motion at any point. And
what's interesting about the procedural posture of this case is that if you read our opinion in the direct appeal, the speedy trial issue was considered under plain error because the trial attorneys never raised a speedy trial claim because they couldn't get ready for a trial on any schedule other than the one that eventually evolved. And then in the opinion on direct appeal, this court said, to the extent your attorneys never raised the speedy trial issue, and that implicates ineffective assistance of counsel, we won't address that in a direct appeal. That should be addressed in a post-conviction motion. So here we have Mr. Page going to the Superior Court saying, I lost on a plain error standard of review on the speedy trial issue. I want to develop this ineffective assistance of counsel claim that the Supreme Court seems to have invited me to do in a post-conviction relief claim, and it's summarily denied.
Yes, sir.
So why should we, you know, what alternative would we have but to remand in order for the record to be developed?
Because the state would suggest, Your Honor, the record is clear as to why each delay in this case took place.
All right. Well, let's talk about that. And I understand this has nothing to do with the state attorney general's office, but you're here in this proceeding representing the state of Delaware's position. And we've just heard from Mr. Lawless about a long line of U.S. Supreme Court cases that say the state, by virtue of the 14th Amendment, has an obligation to provide you with effective assistance of counsel. Hypothetically, in this case, if the Superior Court said, I'm appointing Mr. Figliola and Mr. Gabe to represent you, however, they're not available for 5 years. So I'm appointing counsel, but you're not going to have a trial for 5 years. When their schedules free up. Would you agree that that would appear to be a problem under the United States Constitution?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
All right. So we're on a continuum here, like people like to ask in law school. In this particular case, the record reflects unequivocally that Mr. Gabe and Figliola were appointed, and on day one, they said, we want you to know, if you appoint us, we can't comply with the administrative directive. So by definition, this trial can't commence within the guidelines of the administrative directive because of our schedule. Why isn't incumbent upon the state to appoint attorneys that can get the trial within the administrative directive?
Well, Your Honor, if I may, just to clear up the factual record here, Mr. Page was first arrested in November of 2000. At that point, the Public Defender Service was appointed to represent him. They did not officially withdraw from representation until April 20th of 2001, at which point Mr. Gabay is appointed, and there is a status conference held in June about scheduling. The first trial date in that case is scheduled for, February 21st through March 29th of 2002. It's scheduled for a 3 to 4 week trial at that point. It's not surprising that members of the bar of the experience of Mr. Figliola and Gabay have outstanding trial commitments. However, at this point, to comply with Administrative Directive 88, the trial would have had to have commenced by November 20th of 2000.
I understand, but my question is more general. You have a person charged with first-degree murder. The state has decided it wants to seek the death penalty. We know that he's entitled to have an attorney appointed. The question is, what is the state's obligation in appointing an attorney? And your answer seems to be, well, it took the public defender, a system set up by the state, a long time to find out they had a conflict. Then it took the Superior Court a while to get things scheduled. And then we found out Mr. Gabay was busy in other matters, and that's all on the record, and therefore it's no problem for Mr. Page. But what we're hearing from Mr. Lawless is Mr. Page wanted an attorney that was ready to go in a timely way. My question for you is, why doesn't the state have an obligation to appoint an attorney that is able to proceed in a timely way?
Certainly that's the case, Your Honor. The state does have an obligation to do so, and the state would argue that here that happened. Under the U.S. Supreme Court case in Vermont v. Brilliant, the state cannot be charged with the time that the Public Defender Service spent figuring out that they had a conflict.
Well, we're talking about a speedy trial violation there. The focus of this post-conviction proceeding is on ineffective assistance of counsel. The argument we're being presented today is that putting the speedy trial issue aside, we have a structural problem because an attorney was appointed who couldn't proceed in a timely way, and it was compounded when the attorney was ready to proceed by inadequate funding for experts.
Yes, Your Honor. And the state would suggest that they did appoint competent counsel who was ready to proceed within the time allotted.
How can you say that?
Because Mr. Page's characterization of the first act of counsel was saying we need to push this back because we're too busy is mischaracterizing the steps that had been taken up till that point, and that this was a normal trial schedule of an extremely complicated, long-duration trial that needed to be scheduled. And to schedule that trial to begin before November would have materially harmed his defense, and every delay in this case worked to his benefit.
And why isn't he entitled to make a record on that issue?
The fact is he's not entitled to make a record on that issue now because he has not alleged any prejudice he suffered from any delay. The delays in this case can be attributed first to...
Well, you keep focusing on delay, which relates to speedy trial. But if you look at the briefs, one of the allegations in the briefs is that there were absolutely no pretrial motions.
And that's incorrect, Ron.
Exactly. But that's something that could be developed in a record. What we need to deal with here from an institutional point of view is the doctrine or the jurisprudence of this court that says, you can't raise ineffective assistance of counsel in a direct appeal. Raise it in a post-conviction proceeding. Then we get to the post-conviction proceeding. And there may be some cases, and we've said this many times, where a motion for post-conviction release can be summarily denied. But there are other situations, perhaps when you're charged with a capital case and you're ultimately convicted of first-degree murder, where it can only be decided with a hearing. And that's really the issue in this appeal. Mr. Lawless is saying this is the type of post-conviction proceeding that merits a hearing because my claim of ineffective assistance of counsel can't be developed without additional facts. And going back to my earlier point, we seem to have invited them to do that in the direct appeal.
And that's not an uncommon, as Your Honors are obviously well aware, that's not an uncommon phrase in a direct appeal, particularly in pro se cases where a defendant will allege ineffectiveness in direct appeal, and it's referred to the Superior Court for judgment on the merits the first time. Here, none of the allegations required further inquiry. As to no pretrial motions, this court noted in its direct appeal that Mr. Gabay was the primary person driving the Bryce certified questions, which addressed all of the concerns of all of the capital defendants regarding the efficacy of the death penalty statute in this state. He hasn't alleged...
You mean after Ring versus Arizona?
After Ring versus Arizona, Your Honor. And he has not alleged what other meritorious motions should have been filed. The motion that he filed in this case, aside from the Bryce-related stay request, was to get a proof positive hearing, which he received. And he hasn't alleged that there were any other cause for any other meritorious motion. Certainly, Mr. Gabay was not required to file frivolous motions challenging various different pieces of evidence. He has never alleged what specific motions to file.
But wouldn't it have been helpful if we had Mr. Gabay's affidavit?
Given the allegations in the post-conviction motion, Your Honor, I would suggest that the affidavit of Mr. Figliola was an appropriate response.
So if our court leaves the record the way it is, what does that say to conflict counsel, that an order from the Superior Court to file an affidavit is optional, it's discretionary, you don't have to do it if you don't want to do it?
Certainly I would suggest that's not the case, Your Honor.
No, however, it's not the case, but if we leave this record the way it is, what are the implications?
The only thing the state can suggest, Your Honor, is that Mr. Figliola was speaking on behalf of the trial team. If there's no response from the trial team, then it's certainly problematic. But here there was a response, though it is not clear from the face of the affidavit that he intended to speak for both Mr. Figliola, that is, intended to speak for both he and Mr. Gabay. Certainly the comments that he made to Mr. Page's counsel indicate that. And there's no basis to conclude that any affidavit from Mr. Gabay would change the result here. The allegations were too general. They allege no prejudice. And in fact, each delay in this case, the meat of the matter, at least according to Mr. Page, accrued to his benefit. Every time this stopped, there was more time for investigation. There was resolution of the Bryce questions. There was more money for financing, for funding. And each time, he got a benefit out of this. Ultimately, he received the ultimate benefit out of this case when the U.S. Supreme Court declared that it would be illegal to sentence his co-defendant to death. And that was key in deciding that Mr. Page need not receive the death penalty. Judge Abelman made that abundantly clear in her opinion, in her sentencing decision. That delay work to his ultimate benefit here, because as Judge Abelman indicated, she would have sentenced Mr. Jones to death, and that would have certainly colored her impression of what Mr. Page should have received as the ultimate punishment. If the court has no further questions, the state will rest on its brief. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
With the court's permission, unless the court has any further questions, I think probably the most appropriate resolution, although, frankly, I think the ineffectiveness argument based on a systemic problem standing alone in and of itself would warrant the relief we're seeking. I don't think I have any further argument. I think the court understands the situation before it and would have nothing more, and I would thank the court for its attention.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take the matter under advisement. Also take a brief recess.